if we can begin this morning's hearing, the first bill we have on the agenda is House File 1724, Senator Torres-Ray. And what we're going to do, obviously we'll give Senator Torres-Ray an opportunity to begin the presentation, and recognizing that there's been a lot of discussion about this bill. Normally in the Finance Committee, we don't take testimony unless the bill has not been heard in a previous committee. I think this bill has been through, what, the Policy Committee and then Senator Berglund's division. Is that correct?
Been through more than that.
Mr. Chairman, we've gone through three committees in the Senate, higher education, health, housing, and family security, and health care.
So obviously there's been a chance for a great deal of testimony, so normally we would not take testimony in the Finance Committee, but with the number of people interested in this bill, we decided we would take 15 minutes of testimony on each side.
Thank you.
And we do have several people who've signed up to testify, so we'll obviously take proponents first and then opponents. But first, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would like to start by saying that I have accepted the House language in this bill. The House and the Senate language is, for the most part, the same. The main differences between House and Senate version is that the House language included an advisory council that the Senate language did not. And I have an amendment to the House language that will make minor changes to the House bill. That's the A4 amendment, Mr. Chairman. Can I proceed to?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A4 amendment really does some minor changes, clarification, some language that was really not properly written, so most of this is terminology. But there are three substantive changes. One is clarifying the definition of naturopathic doctor. Clarifies that in the definition of a registered naturopathic doctor, the individual must be registered under this chapter, and making it clear, clearer that an individual cannot use the title to imply that they are registered naturopathic doctors unless they are registered. The second one removes the use of the title registered naturopath. There was some discussion, Mr. Chairman, that has been going around the use of ND, naturopath, registered naturopath, naturopath doctor. Apparently, many people in the field use ND, and our intent is really not to prohibit that. There is still some discussion as to who should be using it or not using it, whether or not that is legal or not. But at this point, we're not ready really to do that investigation. We will just like to leave that under Chapter 146, and we really don't want to interfere with that process. And the third one is the changes, the penalty from gross misdemeanor to just misdemeanor. And those are the three substantive changes that are in the amendment that is before you.
Okay, at the request of Senator Torres-Ray, we have the A4 amendment to put it.
I'll move the amendment.
Okay, Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, as you stated earlier, we've gone through different committees and have had ample opportunity to talk about this bill. I understand that many of you have been called by many constituents who are really in favor, some who are opposed, and I think that's exactly what is happening, that we have, this is an area of practice that is really growing, and that is precisely the reason for why we really want to pay attention to this. I want to clarify to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, that this is not a licensing bill. It is not. And so there has been a lot of speculation about my intent and what I want to do with this and how I want to move into licensing and what this next step may be. And I want to make it absolutely clear and leave this on the record. This is not a licensing bill. I am not proposing to do this in this language. And it's clear that this particular bill simply creates a registry for naturopathic doctors that have 4 years of undergraduate training and 4 years of education and training in a federally accredited residential naturopathic medical school. And that is all it does. And, Mr. Chairman, since you are giving us 15 minutes, I have three people who wish to testify and respond to your questions. I would like to invite Dr. Bill Manahan, Mr. David Coons, and Mr. Paul Midman.
Okay. Senator Torres-Ray, before we have the testimony now, the bill is in finance because there's a fee established. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I think this is the main thing that I was supposed to say. That is correct. And so in Section 10, you will see that we have a provision for the fees that the people who will register under this registry will have to pay, and the registration application fee is $200. The renewal fee is $150. There is a late fee of $75 and an inactive status fee of $50. And finally, there is a temporary permit fee of $25, and I believe that you have the fiscal note in front of you. I think this is an equivalent of similar practice, and these numbers come from basically an analysis of equivalent practice, and the fees are similar.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, what's the difference between licensure and registration in your perspective? You said this isn't licensure, but I was looking at what you changed in terms of gross misdemeanor, removing gross, and what it's not expected to limit. But it kind of lumps, can't restrict people from another state that come in here to practice, and it just kind of lumps licensed, registered, or certified in another state as all kind of in one. Are they different terminology for the same thing, or are they different?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, actually these fees are only for people who will actually want to be in the registry. They will not receive a license, but they will have their name in the registry. And people who have not gone through the process of putting their names in this registry cannot claim that they are part of this registry. So that's really all it does. As you can see, this is really not language that we normally, in the licensing process, there will be a description of, lengthy description of the different practices, and we don't have that in here. So this is, in order to open a registry, Senator Olson, it is my understanding that you also have to have some language that really describes who is registered in this system. So it's a little bit descriptive in the sense that we cannot just say, this registry is intended to really have people who have a specific training, and these are people who have these 7 years of more training in an accredited school. And we have to describe the terminology of, you know, what accredited school means, what is the practice, because we're establishing this registry. So we explain the terminology associated with the registry, but we don't go as far as describing all the steps for licensure.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, let me see if I can help. There are three levels that we work with in human services type licensing. And licensure is the most restrictive. You are licensed to be a doctor. You are licensed to be a nurse. The next level lower than that is certification. You have you're a certified certified something or another.
Public accountant.
Public accountant, okay. And then the least restrictive is the registration. And it's a list of people who have these qualifications that Senator Torres-Ray was working at. So this is the least restrictive of the three areas that we do in licensure type things. This is not licensing. This is a list. Did that help?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, it sounds almost like it's a little bit of an art form. There's a scope of practice. There's conditions and descriptions of the nature of the educational program in here. I was just trying to determine what's that much different between that and one of those other levels.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think it's how much it is. You know, if you're going to be a licensed physician, you would have, you know, a big, long scope of practice, a big, long educational list. And for certification, it would be smaller. And then for registration, it's even smaller. And this is the smallest of the three.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
It goes beyond that. I mean, if we license a professional occupation, you cannot practice in that occupation without a license. You know, you and I can't go out and become doctors because we don't have licenses. But, you know, if you have a license and you can do that, certification means that, you know, it's a higher standard, but you can go to a certified public accountant or a certified accountant to have your taxes done, or an accountant. I mean, you know, either one can do it for you. And registration simply, is a list that's being maintained, and I suppose it appears to me that this bill just has certain things you have to do, but this doesn't say that who can or cannot practice. It just says who can be on this particular list that's maintained. It's just a registered list. It doesn't define any scope of practice.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up. What other areas do we do registry versus certification or licensure? Is this new, or are there other categories?
Mr. Chairman, I may Senator have an answer for that, Senator Olson. One of the reasons, Senator Olson, that we are in this step is because this is the only step that the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice would agree to. This process initiated 10 years ago, and the process that some people are pursuing are the licensure, and that's why I stated that at the very beginning, that I want to make that clear. They've worked very hard, and I'm pretty sure that we will be talking about this in the future. If we've talked for 10 years, I do not expect that we are going to stop talking today. But this is a process to open an opportunity for a dialogue, to open this registry and see what happens in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, just a response to Senator Betzel's. Even if you have a licensure situation, some people can still practice if we don't forbid it. For example, I had legislation about 10 years ago that licensed traditional midwives, but we only said that, you know, we had a licensing process and educational process, et cetera, but it just meant that you could still practice midwifery, you just couldn't call yourself a licensed traditional midwife. So we didn't outlaw the practice totally. We just created an avenue for people who wanted to get licensure, and it was like a consumer issue. So consumers would have the choice to go to a licensed traditional midwife, and they knew what their training was and what their experience was, or they could choose to go to a traditional midwife who hadn't gone through a licensing process, and that still was legal.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, maybe someone can help me out with this, but the way I understand this is under the scope of practice that's on page 2 and 3, these are new procedures. There are additional things that the doctors of naturopathy will be able to do that they are not allowed to do now. So this adds procedures.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, my understanding is that they currently do this. And again, the purpose of this is really to make sure that we make it clear in the legislation that we are not going to really establish a registry that opens the door for any practice, but it is the current practice. But we have three doctors. We have a doctor and two other testifiers that will be able to respond to your question, because my understanding is that this current practice is common practice, and that's precisely why it is described in the legislation, to make sure that we put some parameters around the practice.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, as people come up, I really would like, because my understanding was that some of these things are not being done right now, although they are trained to do them. The doctors are trained to do them. They are currently not allowed to.
I'll ask
Senator Torres-Ray, anything else that you wish to present at this time, or?
Mr. Chairman, if it is okay with you and the members, I'd like to call the people to testify and continue to respond to questions that you may have.
Senator Tomassoni?
Senator Torres-Rae, the amendment you put on line 1.16, deleted ND on page 4, line 33, does that speak to this email that I got that says, I am told this bill will in no way prevent me from practicing as I currently do under MS 146A, but it does. I have recently graduated and currently apprenticing under another traditional naturopath. I am in a difficult and crucial point in building my own practice. I have invested time and money into advertising, business card brochures, printing costs, product inventory. This bill will force me to throw these items out and recreate all my documents to show that I have graduated with an ND but cannot call myself a naturopath due to the law. Does deleting that ND address this issue?
Senator Torres-Rae.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Tomassoni, correct. That's the reason we put this amendment in there. There is some kind of a discussion going on right now as to whether or not it is allowed under current policy to use the term ND. Now, the intent, however, is not to prevent people because people are using that term. So I want to make sure that people understand that we're really not trying to interfere with current practice. Furthermore, Senator Tomassoni, I would like to point to page 5 of the legislation in subdivision 2, which I really would like to ask you and other members who have received calls, because this was intentionally put in here to protect current practitioners. In here, in subdivision 2, number 2, it says that the provision of the complementary and alternative healing methods and treatments, including naturopathy, which is what your constituent is talking about, as described in Chapter 146. In there, it says that other healthcare practitioners, this needs to be read with subdivision 2, nothing in this chapter may be construed to prohibit that. Nothing in this chapter. It says here at the very beginning, very clear in subdivision 2, it protects the current practitioners. But we went as far as deleting ND just to make sure that there is no doubt in people's mind that we want to protect that practice. We don't want to interfere with current practice.
Senator Torres-Rae, did you wish to have your witnesses testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I would like to call.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Senator Betzel.
Could we get a clarification? I mean, I believe this bill must have gone through the Health and Family Security Committee.
Yes.
I believe that the issues as to whether or not what the scope of practice is and whether they can or cannot do this, and this is the Finance Committee. So are we going to spend our time?
Senator Betzel, I'm not sure if you were here at the outset.
I was not.
Okay.
I had to get my case.
I indicated at the outset that, as you suggest, that normally, and I verified with Senator Torres-Rae that this bill has been through a couple of policy committees. But I said because of the attention being paid to this, the number of people who are interested in it, I would make the exception to the rule and allow some limited testimony on the issue on both sides. But I indicate that at the outset.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here for that.
And obviously, as Senator Torres-Rae has indicated, the finance issues in front of us are pretty limited. It's simply a question of a registration fee, and that's basically it. But because of the accentuated attention, I thought it appropriate to have at least a few minutes of testimony so those of us who have not heard the bill in the policy committee have a better understanding of what the bill is. And we'll indicate again we're limiting the testimony to 15 minutes on each side, opponents and proponents. So I'm not sure who wishes to proceed if it's – okay, Dr. Mittman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the privilege of testifying. My name is Paul Mittman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, having graduated from National College of Naturopathic Medicine in 1985. I'm also a student pursuing my doctorate in education at the University of Pennsylvania. And I am the president of Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, a four-year, not-for-profit, accredited naturopathic medical school in Tempe, Arizona. My tenure as president at the college began in 1999, and as is sometimes the case in higher education, it started under rather stressful circumstances. The school was under financial distress at the time, as a result of building a medical center and purchasing a new campus in order to provide students with larger and more modern classrooms, laboratory, and library facilities. And I'm proud to say that by the end of 99, the college was in the black and made such a rapid turnaround that for a number of years, the Department of Ed referred schools in financial difficulty to us for advice. Since that time, we've outgrown that medical center, expanded our campus, and increased our student body by nearly 70%. Today, our enrollment is at an all-time high. There are some who claim that naturopathic medical education is the same, whether it is at an accredited four-year naturopathic medical school, an online school, or a mail-order school. And nothing could be further from the truth. And I'd like to show with you seven reasons why the Princeton Review of the top 168 medical schools in America includes only accredited naturopathic medical schools. They list three distinct types of medical schools right in the table of contents: allopathic profiles, osteopathic profiles, and naturopathic profiles. I don't have a copy for each of you, but you're welcome to peruse this volume if you wish. So here are the top seven. I would have had a top 10, except our testimony is limited, as you know, and so I'll restrict it to seven. First of all, is student standards. You have to be accepted. And to enroll at SCNM, a student must have a bachelor's degree and a pre-med background. The average cumulative GPA for students enrolling at our school is 3.25, and it's 3.5 for the pre-med courses, which are the same as for any other medical school. One student is accepted for every three that apply. Faculty. We have 21 full-time faculty for our 330 students and many adjunct. They include 6 PhDs, 3 are medical doctors, and 12 naturopathic doctors. 10 of the 12 NDs graduated from schools other than Southwest College. 2 have 29 years of experience, 1 with 25, 3 with 20 to 23 years. Only 4 have been in practice less than 10 years. Number 3 is a 4,000-hour curriculum. Students attending an accredited naturopathic medical school must take a full year of gross anatomy, including cadaver dissection lab, biochem, physiology, microbiology, pathology, lab and clinical diagnosis, pharmacology, nutrition, botanical medicine, and other naturopathic modalities. During the third and fourth years, students engage in over 1,300 hours of clinical training under the direct supervision of licensed physicians. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there are some who say that this is not traditional naturopathy. To them, I say, wake up. This is the 21st century, and every health profession must be grounded in science and must be taught by qualified faculty. Number 4, our students take national board exams. All students are required to take and pass national board exams twice: the basic sciences given between the second and third years, and clinical boards after graduation. The fifth is research. Our school engages in research in collaboration with universities such as the Arizona State University, University of Arizona, Translational Genomics Institute, and other schools. Accredited naturopathic medical schools critically evaluate our therapies, no matter how old or traditional they are, and conduct studies funded by the National Institutes of Health. Our work has been published in the Journal of Family Practice, the Alternative Medicine Review, bless you, Annals of Pharmacotherapy, Osteoarthritis and Cartilage, and the Journal of the American Medical Association. Number 6, the U.S. federal government. Our students are eligible to receive federally backed student loans. Their borrowing limits under the Stafford Loan Program are the same as for allopathic, osteopathic, dental, or chiropractic medical students. And I'm proud to report that our graduates' default rate, the percentage who default on their loans, is zero. And finally, accreditation. Voluntary accreditation by a federally recognized accrediting agency is the very signature of American higher education. The naturopathic medical schools in this guide submit to the scrutiny of two accrediting bodies, the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education and the appropriate regional accrediting agency. In our case, it's the North Central Association of Colleges and Schools, the same organization that accredits colleges and universities in Minnesota. I'm here because for the last 23 years, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I dedicated my professional life to the advancement of the naturopathic profession. Now, every profession is defined by standards, standards that students aspire to, standards that our schools must live up to, and standards that our graduates can be held accountable to, and most importantly, standards that our patients can count on. And that is what registration of naturopathic doctors in Minnesota will provide, and the public deserves nothing less. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Mr. Coons.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, once again, what was the default percentage on your loans?
Zero.
Zero, okay.
Mr.
I thought that's what I heard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I apologize. The default rate is zero. The default rate is given each year. For the past 9 years that I've been president, 1 year our default rate was in the 3% range, but every other year it's been zero.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Coons. I'm Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. I'm here today in support of this legislation. Over 3 years ago, we began meeting with this group of people, and we've supported their efforts for the last 3 years. They've made many changes. But as we move forward in the healthcare delivery system and where we're going in the future, it's going to be based on outcomes, on best practices, and we believe there's an important role for naturopathic medicine in the delivery system, and we need to partner with this group who are registered. Our members are asking for that, and that's why we're here in support today. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr.
Monahan? I'm Bill Monahan, and I'm a medical doctor. And to make it brief, I have been grounded in medical practice for a long time. For about 15 years, I was on the clinical faculty at Mayo Medical School. The last 20 years, I've been an assistant professor at the medical school here in Minneapolis. I was medical director of the hospital in Mankato during the 90s, and I started and was director of the first rural family practice residency in Minnesota, the Waseca-Mankato program. So I love and am grounded in Western allopathic medicine. At the same time, I've been president of the American Holistic Medical Association. I started one of the first integrative clinics in the United States in Mankato in the 80s. And so I've worked with all kinds of other non-medical practitioners and see them as extremely important and useful. I mainly just, rather than going into details, want to say that I am strongly supportive of registration of the naturopathic physicians for all the reasons that Dr. Mittman just described earlier. And I also have a letter I want to pass out from the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice from Robert Leach, the executive director. He's worked with the naturopaths and their lobbyist and to develop a bill which is administrable and consistent with the other health professional credentialing statutes under our jurisdiction. And he is for the proposed legislation. So, thank you.
And Doctor, if I can inquire, have you been involved with other kinds of licensure or similar proposals with other types of disciplines?
No.
So it brings you, relative to this legislation, has been your ongoing interest in holistic medicine? Is that kind of the unique aspect of this? Or
I think a couple of things. One is that interest and trying to always think of what's going to be best for our patients. And I think for the reasons Dr. Mittman said, there are different, you know, we need a registration for a group that has 4 years of pre-med and 4 years of a medical school as compared to other training. I still am totally for the 146A CAM law that allows people to attend, see all night natural practitioners. I think that was a great piece of legislation. This is just sort of defines who certain people are, and I think that's important.
And is your professorship, I wasn't quite sure I caught it, in the context of your professorship, if it's clinical or otherwise, is there any discussion of holistic medicine?
You know, these last 12 or 14 years at the university, I've been part of the Center for Spirituality and Healing. It's part of the Academic Health Center and is in all the dental, nursing, medical school at the University of Minnesota here. And I teach courses there in these types of in holistic and integrative medicine, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you. Does the Board of Medical... is it the Board of Medical Practice? Do they have jurisdiction over all of the health care providers, not just the physicians, but like the other kinds of services that are provided, let's say radiology, you know, the other services?
It has to do with the party.
Senator
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, a physician would be practicing in the area of radiology. There are different specialties within the area of physician practice. But other professionals, like nurses, have their own board. Chiropractors have their own board.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions from committee members? Thank you, Doctor. Okay. Then we're going to have a few minutes, up to the 15 minutes for opponents of the legislation. We have a list of several people who signed up to testify, with Mr. Erickson being the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Senator Torres-Ray. My name is Jim Erickson. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Natural Health, a Washington-based organization supporting consumers and practitioners of natural health and alternative medicine, particularly the freedom of practice in natural health. We were active, as many of you know, in the passage of the Complementary and Alternative Medicine chapter in 2000, and I checked, and everyone on this committee who was here then voted for it. We thank you for that. We are here to support that. My client, Boyd Landry, cannot be here today, but I want to give you the benefit of our national experience with respect to this. I want to draw a bright line between our nationally based concerns and the local impact that you will hear from with other practitioners and testifiers following me. I'd like to address the fiscal issues that are relevant to this committee, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to point out, and I think that the math will tell you, that this bill is not self-funding. The assumption in the fiscal note is that it is. But I want to suggest that it's very simple to take a look and see that it is not. There are, by the testimony that's been presented before, some 15 to 26 individuals who would benefit from this bill. Let's say 20. Practice, Kansas has a similar registration bill, and it took 5 years for their registered base to go from under one half of the eligible practitioners to most of them. Do the math. A $200 registration fee times 10 or even 20 does not meet the $8,000 budgeted here. It may seem small, but I think we know that this legislation, the legislature is very cognizant about even small amounts. I'm also curious to know why the fiscal note, which is presented now, alleges that it's an $8,000 cost next year, and a fiscal note drawn just less than 1 month ago said $13,000. So perhaps someone could enlighten me as to why the estimate has gone down. Well, the bill now has gone from having an advisor, no advisory committee, in its form before the Senate, to now including an advisory committee. I think the math will indicate that this does not self-fund itself, and I would hope you as fiscal agents of the state would consider that. I spoke about the advisory board. The advisory board, which was in original legislation, was taken out in the Senate Judiciary Committee, perhaps simply not so the bill didn't have to go to the Policy Committee in Government Operations. Now it's brought back, perhaps simply to avoid a conference committee. I don't know that facile switch is something the way we should do it. I think there should be a debate about whether there should be an advisory board, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. Your Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Mua's committee, did good work on the bill. The advisory committee was taken out, and they spent a lot of time, through Senator Olson, on the informed consent section. now, if you ignore the Senate version and try to attempt to pass the House version, that good work of that committee is not around. The local organizations that will follow me will address the larger and significant concerns they have about the impact of the bill and the arguments that are on the impact on complementary and alternative medicine. I won't speculate about that. Let me address the committee about what the bill does do. The bill is its principal objective. It gives a small group access to and protection for the use of the term doctor. And it defines a scope of practice that only they can provide. I'm sorry to say that Senator Torres Rey is misinformed when she tells you that the scope of practice set forth in this bill on page 2 and 3 is something that can be performed by individuals that practice under 147A now. It is not. This bill creates a new scope of practice and allows only those people who qualify for registration, that small group, to use the very important term doctor. Doctor is an important pronoun, important noun. It should not be awarded lightly. Chapter 214 that this legislature passed requires healthcare licensing proposals to be carefully vetted before coming to this body. That was not done in this case, and it should be done. The proponents of the bill suggest this bill has been around for 11 years and has not passed. There's good reason it has not. It was in the form of licensing, but really, what is the difference between licensing and registration? Registration, I suggest, is licensing light without the protections that you wrap around licensing. The complementary and alternative practice chapter that many of you voted for is working. Why change it? Why all this fuss and furor over enhancing 20 individuals' position in the marketplace? How is the public benefited? That is the test of this legislation and whether the state would spend any money doing it. That's the test that Chapter 214 requires you to apply, and no 214 required vetting was done with respect to this bill. Licensing or registration is not more palatable and should not be more than licensing. If licensing is warranted by this group of people that want to use the term doctor and wish to protect that title, then the vigorous and rigorous protection of licensing should be required. Registration lowers the bar of any public protection. The best analogy I can think of, if you will, is this. Lawyers who went to a certain law school and have been self-endorsed by a small group of also eligible lawyers might want to be called super lawyers. When I practiced in this body as an active governmental relations, I was pleased to be on the list of super lawyers. I was one of them. But imagine if I had come and that small group of us had come to you and said that we wanted to protect that title. No one else could use it because we'd gone to a certain school and we'd self-selected ourselves. I think that analogy is correct, and that what I think is being suggested here. I'm not here to suggest that the education and the qualifications of those individuals that seek that additional protection is not worthy. But is it worthy of that protection and the limitation on the practice, and should they be given with that amount of education, the title doctor? Let me just ask you to look at the advisory board, for example. I mentioned that. If you would look on page, where is it? Yeah. Where did the advisory board go? South 224. Last page? Yes, excuse me, the advisory council. Section 9 of the bill on page 11. It requires that the board, this is the medical board, shall appoint a 7-person registered naturopathic doctor advisory council. Guess who's on it? One member of the public, 5 registered naturopathic doctors. Now, how are we going to create a board when there's no such thing until they register? And then that board will advise about how you get registered. I don't think that registration, that self-designation, and a board controlled only by 5 of the 20 or so individuals who are eligible to this is in the best interest of the public. It's self-regulation and self-defining for a small group. Again, the fiscal issue is you're spending money here in the state, I think it's demonstrably, and is it worth doing so? I think this bill is not ready for prime time, and I do respect and suggest that the legislature and this committee find an alternative to continue to study this in the context of the required 214 report and lay the bill over. Thank you very much for your time and attention, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Okay, we have several minutes left for opponents. The next person on the list is Ms. Murphy.
Thank you. May I pass some literature out?
Or? Certainly.
Can I have some help?
They will. Page one.
Thank you. My name is Katie Murphy, and I'm a business owner in the Twin Cities here. I was born and raised here. I own two clinics, one in Woodbury and one in Bloomington. I employ a couple office staff, and there are several therapists who work out of the clinics. And I have several concerns about this bill and actually this process. First of all, in talking with individual senators and representatives over the last few weeks, I was kind of a come lately on the spot here. During the last few weeks, there were some considerable lack of information, if you will, about our marketplace and about the people who come to receive therapies and information from our marketplace. And I would like to address this issue. First of all, I'd like to say that on behalf of hundreds of practitioners, and I'm not talking a few, I'm talking hundreds of practitioners, we oppose the naturopathic registration bill for the following unacceptable claims. Number one, naturopath is just a general name describing a lifestyle and those who practice natural therapies which promote the body's own healing abilities. This bill tries to take possession of the various and generally used nicknames for naturopath practitioners and their educational acronyms, MD, even though that seems to have been changed just recently, for the registration and exclusive use of graduates from a select group of educational institutions. And over and over again, I continue to hear them refer to other practitioners as computer school and mail order correspondent school educated. I take great issue with that. This bill defines naturopathic medicine as including the healing elements of air, water, light, sound, vibration, food, herbs, etc. These are not medicines. They are simply life. All cultures, and therefore all people, practice natural health care or naturopathy. This bill inappropriately tries to redefine a multicultural lifestyle as a form of medicine. Some say we, the opposition, are just suffering from unfounded fear of not being able to continue to practice. As a registration bill, it does not legally prevent us from practicing, we are told. But is the fear unfounded? One of the largest growth sectors in our country's economy is the natural healthcare industry. Money is a strong incentive for regulation and control. The Board of Medical Practice removed all of the overlapping medical scope of practice originally written in this bill regarding surgery, birthing, prescriptions, etc. If the scope of practice is irrelevant, descriptive fluff, then why did the Board of Medical Practice consider it so important to remove their scope? I take great concern when talking about the scope of practice in this particular bill. I've heard just this morning it referenced to be the difference between licensure and registration as how much more you can put in your scope of practice. Their description of naturopathy is defining everything under the sun and every single therapy that each one of us hundreds practice. And we specialize in those therapies with much more education, much more practice and experience for each one of those than they have in their general view in the few courses that they take as electives on top of their allopathic medical courses. During a discussion, Senator Torres Ray informed us that it was the Board of Medical Practice that wrote the naturopathic scope of practice. Ask yourself why. One of the questions that was asked today is, does the scope of practice expand the Board of Medical Practice regulation abilities? I would argue strongly that it does. And I also argue that this is the objective of this bill, not the name of doctor for 24 naturopaths. That might be their objective. But I have seen and witnessed many well-paid lobbyists who are working very strongly for this bill. There has to be some other alternatives in my suspicions. Also, proponents have stated very clearly they intend to introduce a license bill next year. This has been said many times, maybe not in your room, but we've heard it. If this bill is passed, then Senate File 1520 Scope of Practice will be introduced as a precedent for the license bill. Everyone knows the scope of practice in a license bill reserves those practices exclusively for the licensed person, except where overlapping scopes of practice are noted. This bill lists every natural health practice and therapy under the sun as their ability in their scope of practice.
Ms. Murphy,
am I out of time?
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and so you've got two other witnesses. We're out of time now.
Okay.
Well, let me just offer the witnesses a minute of testimony, and I don't know if Senator Torres-Ray, if your witnesses would like another minute, but we are running out of time.
Apologize.
And I would remind members, we have Senator Betzold's bill on the agenda, and you'll recall Senator Pogemiller's admonition to us last night relative to the start of session. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni?
Chairman, could the witnesses comment on the scope of practice that's in this bill and then how that it relates to subdivision 2 on page 5, which talks about nothing in this chapter may be construed to prohibit or restrict. Can you kind of link those two and let us know if one does something the other one doesn't do, or if either one of them does something that doesn't allow the naturopaths to do what they do now?
I'm worried,
we have a scope of practice that's in this bill that apparently is all new language, so it appears to be a new scope of practice. But then there's also language in the bill that says that nothing in this chapter may be construed to prohibit or restrict anything that's done in Chapter 146A, which is what you do now. So I'm wondering if those two are related in such a way that one negates the other, or if the new people can do something that the old people can't do, or if the old people can't do something they used to do.
I think that's a very good legal question. I think this question and several others regarding some of the language of this bill should be more thoroughly discussed before we continue to pass an important piece of legislature as this.
Ms. Studer and Mr. Schmidt, do you want to offer a little bit of testimony for a minute?
I would like to, if I could, Mr. Chair, and I want to be brief, and I want to thank this Finance Committee for dipping into policy. I know it's not your normal venue, and I very much appreciate that it has happened. I think that what is clear is that there is a difference between how one becomes a naturopath and also how the state of Minnesota looks at the education requirements. And we're kind of all talking around an issue. I will be very honest in saying I have been at all but one of the policy discussions that have occurred this session, and we have not had a conversation about the accreditation and about the education. And the fact that none of these schools are in the state of Minnesota, I would look to the Senate for its wisdom in looking at this issue. Several parties on both sides have been correct in saying complementary and alternative healthcare is growing in massive amounts, and it is very necessary. Minnesota was the first state of the union, and as a previous witness testified, this entire committee voted to approve Chapter 146A. Everybody can practice under 146A right now. This is not a licensure bill. It is a registration bill. However, many of the questions that have been raised in the verbiage of this bill, particularly in the House form of the bill, it's set up as a licensure bill, only it's called registration. And the questions about the scope of practice and all those issues are there because that is the language in the bill. It is not there because we're trying to throw in red herrings. It's the language in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I'm president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. We oppose this bill in its current form. The state's duty to protect citizens from harm is already completely addressed by the provisions of Minnesota Statute 146A and the Office of Complementary and Alternative Practices within the Department of Health, which has oversight and enforcement powers. The expanded scope of practice, primarily medical procedures and provisions, which the proponents sought to reflect their level of training and which would have warranted greater regulation, has been stricken, as has been referenced earlier from the bill. What remains is what they are currently doing, able to offer the public. No greater level of harm has been alleged to those modalities to warrant further regulation than currently exists. The disclosure notice required from these and all who practice complementary and alternative therapies, and which is mandatory before the initial appointment, already gives consumers the ability to differentiate between those practitioners and their differing levels of education and training. And I will close with that since you're short on time.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
All right, Sir Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill.
Okay, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I've got a question. I don't know if council can help me, but I was wondering, because someone mentioned the education, the we recognize any Canadian school here immediately, and I was just wondering if we do that with medical, like an MD, that we recognize Canadian a Canadian education just automatically without them going through the foreign-trained medical doctor process to be licensed in Minnesota, because this Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just wondering if we just automatically recognize.
Well, Senator Fischbach, I'm hoping this will be the chance for Mr. Watson maybe to not answer a question, but give it a try.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm authorized to say that the Office of Senate Counsel and Research is not sure of the answer to that question.
And that's a first. Yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, stumped the Senate Council Day. But I guess I'm just wondering, because that does, you know, as it was mentioned, not, the schools aren't in Minnesota, and so I'm just wondering if we should really even, if the bill is going to progress, if we should have Canada. It's referenced in a couple of places that we just would automatically accept that that training.
So, Senator Fischbach, obviously we don't have an answer at this table. Possibly, Senator Torres-Ray, do you know? Or
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, one thing that I think will be important is to, again, go back to the process of understanding that this is not a licensure. So we're not, in essence, these people will be registering their names and saying that they do have an eight-year degree, maybe, you know, in other countries, in fact. But that doesn't really give them a license to practice because there is not a licensure process. So they are registering their name. I think Canada is named, but I assume that if a person who has an eight-year degree from England or any other country will be also registering their name. It's kind of, for licensure, I think this is a very important question, but this bill is not intending to provide that to open that.
Mr. Chair?
I think Mr. Watson actually might have an answer, but he got some help.
Mr. Chairman, I did get help from Ms. Cavanaugh, who has found that the Board of Medical Practice does recognize graduates of Canadian medical schools.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. But just one, just I just wanted to make a comment, Mr. Chair, regarding I know that it's a registration bill, but you do require, you know, the examination is a naturopathic licensing examination. I mean, so there's, you know, yes, technically it is registration, Senator Torres Ray, but there's a lot of things that look like licensure when the examination that they have to pass is a licensing examination.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, the acronym for the licensing exam dates back to 1986, and it's used in all jurisdictions in North America that either register or license naturopathic doctors. So in states like Kansas, which is a registration, they also use that that examination. It's used because it's a standard examination that's recognized by the Department of Education.
Okay. I'd renew my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Sir Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing that I've been hearing over and over is a concern that is in the bill on page 4, that the word doctor could not be used in association with naturopathic except if it is one of these 20 to 30 people that might be able to register under this bill. And I'm wondering, you know, we use the term doctor for many things and many people who end up with, you know, four-year postgraduate degrees. And, I mean, we have chiropractors. We have people who are PhDs that we call doctors. We call a lot of people doctors. Now, I'm confused. If there are other practitioners in naturopathic medicine or naturopath that have these 4-year post-secondary degrees, they may not be trained in the medical school as much, but they could. I'm still confused why they couldn't be called doctors, and we could just reserve the term physicians for those who have the medical training. And I think that's what a lot of this fight is over right now. And I'm trying to figure out if we couldn't just define this group as physicians, naturopathic physicians, and not worry about that term doctor so much. And I'm just wondering, Senator Torres Ray, if you would comment on that.
Senator Roblin, that language actually is not new language, and I would like to I'll pass this book to you, but this is really defined in statute already. So it's exactly the language that you see in this is in Chapter 146. And so it says specifically in here in Section 146A.08, and this is prohibited conduct. And it goes on to define the use of title of doctor, or physician alone, or in combination with any other words, letters, or insignia to describe the complementary and alternative health care practices the practitioner provides. So it's not language that we are creating that is new. And there has been, Senator Roblin, I think that this issue is going to come up. I think you are really pointing out to something that is very important and is happening. I had numerous calls. I had a conversation with many constituents of yours who are currently using titles and insignias that apparently they are not supposed to. Now, how do the state kind of regulate that and goes out to say they shouldn't? I don't think that is really the intent at this point. We are not really changing the legislation. I really need to repeat this again and again. We are just reinstating what is described in Chapter 146. Now, if people are using titles that they are not supposed to, I don't know what is the enforcing mechanism to do so, but this chapter is very clear about that.
Yep. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, when the time is right, if they're done testifying, I have an amendment I'd like to offer.
But if you'd like to offer it, yes.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a controversial bill. I've had more phone calls.
Senator Vickerman, is there a number? Do you have the amendment to be distributed? The A2 amendment?
My amendment's A-2.
Okay, if we could have that distributed to committee members.
And what it simply does is, Mr. Chair, it gives a little more time, another year to study. If you look at the amendment, I'm trying to get some rational decision out of this, because here we're in a one day or 2 days we're supposed to be hopefully wrapped up.
Thank you.
And this bill can take a lot of time if we want to go further and further and further. And I have great respect for Senator Torres. So what I simply would like to do, I'm going to offer it and see what happens, but on page 5, I want to delete the 2008 and insert 2009. On page 12, after line 11, insert naturopathic work group. This group, if you look on amendment, if it's passed out, would study to see what direction we should be going in. Because I myself could be going in two different directions. So I want to be sure we're going in the one direction.
Mr. Chairman?
I offer the amendment and see what happens.
Okay, Senator Vicker moves the amendment. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I notice on lines 210 and 211 that the Commissioner of Health would be providing support staff meeting space for this work group and compensation for any reimbursement for expenses, and I don't know that you have a means to pay for that in your amendment, Senator Vickerman.
Compensation,
I think it would have some sort of fiscal note on it if they're providing staff and meeting space.
Does serve without compensation.
Well, okay, we have Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, this issue in regard to this legislation has been in this legislature at least since in the last 10 years, and what we're doing is rehashing the same thing over and over again, and I think I would reject this proposed amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray, you're...
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in fact, I was given Senator Foley the studies that have been conducted, and I'll be happy to pass it around. I don't know if you want copies, but you are correct, Senator Foley. This process of studying this issue started in January 15, 1998, and I have a copy of the preliminary recommendations. Then there was a couple of follow-up studies that came up in 2006, and several members who have been here really are aware of this history. So I, Senator Vickerman, I am not sure that another study will really change the outcome. I do, however, want to say that in the future, I would like to continue to support an effort to really engage people in the dialogue, because this is a growing practice, and I think it is important that we talk about it. But at this point, I also would like to acknowledge Representative Neva Walker is here, who's been working on this for 6 years, and she's fully aware of the work that has taken place in the last 10 years, because she's been really working very hard during the last 6 years to do this. So I am only here, have only been working on this for 2 years, but the work has been done.
Okay, we have Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, my thought is that there is obviously a lot of controversy with this, and what Senator Vickerman's amendment would do would be to allow all the language that we have before us to move forward, only we're tagging on the language of another study, bringing these various groups together to talk more about it. And then with a one-year delayed effective date for the main bill. And it just seems like this would be a good way to try to make peace or try to gain some further understanding, and maybe some appropriate changes would be appropriate for the next session that we can implement to try to work this out. There's obviously a lot of controversy here, and this is just one way to talk, get the various groups together that are concerned about this, and perhaps make some modifications in the next session rather than just pass this thing out without any further opportunity for the opponents to interact with the system.
Okay. We have Senator Vickerman's motion on the A2 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion fails. Division. All those in favor of the motion, if you could please raise your hand. Okay, all those opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Murphy.
I think your hearing's going bad.
Apparently. further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion.
Okay, Sir Murphy moves that House File 1724, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Thank Chair.
You. Sir Moore.
Mr. Chair, now that you've taken a vote on this bill, I wish to share some information with this committee. I am very, very, very angry about the opponents to this bill. They went to the Hmong American community, they went on Hmong American radio, and they completely misrepresented the reach and the coverage of this bill. They told the Hmong American community that the intent of this bill was to reach into the homes of Hmong Americans and regulate traditional shaman practices and traditional herbal practices in our households. And then they gave out my home telephone number and the cell phone telephone number for Representative Cy Tao. And for 2.5 hours, from 10 o'clock to midnight on the night that they went on radio, with the House language for the registration, I had to field phone calls at my home on this bill. And I just have to share with the members of this committee, I didn't come here to speak in opposition or for the bill, but I wish to share with you that around this place, we all have strong feelings about specific policies, and we may differ in how we feel about processes and policies, but it was absolutely unacceptable to exploit and to misrepresent this bill and to go into a community that was susceptible because it has traditional practices and to misrepresent the reach of this bill, so that I had to deal with the panic and the concerns in the community from 10 to midnight on a night when I didn't have to and I'd rather spend the time in my home. And so I just want to put the warning out to the very, very zealous opponents to this, that better not happen again.
Okay. Well, there's been a lot of back and forth. I'm sorry. We've got to get to other bills, and we have passed the bill, and would ask if there are problems with proponents and opponents that they try to discuss these differences and take whatever appropriate, if there's a course of action in terms of complaints, the Finance Committee would not be the place to hear them. So thank you, Senator Torres Ray. I should mention that I forgot to mention the vote. I'm sorry, I didn't announce the vote on the amendment, which was 9 in favor, 6 opposed. I apologize. All right, we have next on the agenda Senate File 3535, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chairman,
Sir Murphy.
I'd move the A1 amendment for Senator Olsen so he can get his bill in the shape he wants it.
Okay. First, Senator Murphy moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, then we have, again, Senate File 3535. We're having distributed the A1 amendment. Okay, let's take
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Senator Olsen, I'm going to ask, before we vote on Senator Murphy's amendment, I want to just ask for clarification. In the division report, there was a dollar amount of $1,011,000. This changes it to $1 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to change that number to $575,000.
Okay, do you want to incorporate that in the A1 amendment then?
I would appreciate if you would do that.
Okay, so what is that number again?
$575,000.
Okay, Senator Murphy, does that?
That jives.
Okay. That jives?
That's, yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we had talked about.
Is that a statutory term?
Pardon?
Is that a statutory term?
Mr. Massman would have to answer that. The last time I started answering legal questions, we're still trying to fix up 152.
All right. We have the requested amendment from the author, the A1 amendment as presented by Senator Murphy. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill as amended.
Well, let's give Senator Olsen a chance to tell us what we're voting on. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate Senator Murphy's move to expedite this. This is Senate File 3535, which establishes an Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. State law says that there has to be a director of pupil transportation safety, and Captain Urquhart serves in that position. He also serves as director of commercial enforcement. So we feel that there's been so many things going on in our state with buses and student transportation that we should have a separate office, which would be a lieutenant in the state patrol, with 3 troopers under him and then 15 inspectors. So that's the heart of the bill. I'm here because there is a fiscal note, which you guys already approved, so appreciate that. I would like to address why the fiscal note has shrunk, because Captain Urquhart will be able to assign, or the State Patrol will be able to assign the lieutenant who would become the director of pupil transportation safety. However, the 3 troopers that would be part of this would not be able to be assigned to the office until, I believe it's August 2009, after the trooper school graduates 40 more troopers, because State Patrol is so short of troopers right now that they cannot delegate 3 troopers to this office. So that drops the fiscal note because of their salaries, and also we don't need to purchase their squad cars then until fiscal year 2010. And we'll stand for any questions.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, the 3 troopers that you referenced, would they be working only on school bus safety, or would they also be doing other patrol work?
I'll let Captain Urquhart answer that question.
Captain?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, my name is Ken Urquhart, captain with the State Patrol. It's my interpretation that these 3 troopers, once they're assigned to this program, would be primarily required to be involved in school bus safety issues. That would be their primary role. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't use them for other types of duties, but their primary function and assignment would be in that program.
Sir Berglund?
My question was answered. Thank you.
Okay. Sir Olsen, if I can ask a question. Obviously, the issue is an important one. I'm trying to think. Mr. Watson also raised the question. Do we specify in statute anywhere, you know, the numbers of people involved? You know, we have 3 state troopers and 15 school bus inspectors.
Mr. Chair, the reason that we put that in is that as a minimum, that right now there's 12 inspectors, and through attrition, this number has dropped to 12, and because of budgets, they have not been replaced, the folks that have retired. So that's my understanding of how we got down to 12. And so this, putting that in there, maintains a minimum number, because we want them to do more than just the physical inspections of the bus, which is required by state law. We want more inspectors to give them time to go into the school districts and the bus companies' offices and start going through the driver's records, and making sure that the driver's records are copacetic and that everything is in order.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with the establishment of the office. I understand the need for the office. My question is whether or not we should establish the office and then let, as would normally be the case, the commissioner determine the level of personnel, as opposed to specifying that in statute.
Mr. Chair, if I could address that, and I think practice has shown that what has happened is with attrition, these people haven't been replaced. So I think we have to step up and say we need a minimum number of people. I think we have to kind of force the issue.
Yeah, Sir Murphy?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the State Patrol has done an excellent job in recruiting and actually in retention efforts. The problem is that the State Patrol has traditionally been funded at the basically at the whim of the legislature. So they have it's feast and famine over there. And unfortunately, it's been going through too much famine. And that's why you've seen the numbers shrinking up. We did, with the bill that we passed this year, put more money for more troopers, and so there's going to be more troopers out on the road, but we don't have enough time to get those people up and trained and then, you know, put them in the school bus or in this pupil transportation office. I mean, it's just, it's logistically not possible. But the captain needs to have, and the patrol needs to have, the direction of the legislature to say that this is important. And it is, and Senator Olsen's right. I mean, we've had one school bus crash after another this year, and very unfortunate that we've lost some kids because of it. And I'm not saying that the captain and his folks could have prevented any of those, because probably not. But I tell you what, the one thing that we can prevent is any future, you know, physical violations of the bus itself and of the licensing requirements for the drivers. And if you saw the legislative auditor's report, you know, I don't think that we would be even discussing this. This should have been on the floor. We should pass it. It should be law by now. If somebody read the legislative auditor's report, but... you know, this is a good compromise. I think that SEIU had issues with the bill at the beginning, as well as some private contractors. And I think that what the captain and the senator have done here is good work. We ought to just pass this and make it law.
Okay. Further discussion on Senate File 3535, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if someone could kind of define the responsibilities, the difference between what the state troopers will do and what the inspectors do, because I always thought that the troopers also do inspections.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator, the inspectors at this point in time schedule those inspections. There's about 13,000 to 14,000 school buses that we are required to inspect every year in, year out. In order to accomplish that on that cycle, we have to schedule those with either the private contractor or the school district. Those inspectors work through, logistically work through all those inspections. They also, when time allows them, they examine records, drug and alcohol testing records, driver qualification records. The trooper's role would be primarily linked to the traffic piece, traffic enforcement, the school bus stop arms, the unannounced checks on drivers to ensure that we don't have impaired drivers. We've had issues here recently with impaired drivers in school buses, alcohol, drugs, and that's what the trooper's role would be, that unannounced traffic enforcement. The inspectors don't have the authority to do that. They're just a commercial vehicle inspector. They're not peace officers. So we need that two-pronged focus on the school bus safety program. Of course, some local law enforcement agencies don't see school bus stop arm violations as a priority, so then those things are sent to us, and we try to assign troopers to do some of that, but you know, we can't get to all of those that are sent to us. So we really want the troopers focused on that traffic enforcement and the inspectors focused on the carrier aspect, the buses and the documents that are kept at the school district or at the private contractor.
Okay. Further discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Just to, add to the discussion a little bit, I think for the most part, and I realize that we've had a series or several accidents this year, for the most part our children are transported relatively safely. You know, for the millions of miles that are put on each year, it's you know, we can feel very good about our schools, and our schools take this this job very seriously too. But one of the things that's happened, and we'll hear more about it next year, is that we're not funding our the cost of our transportation system the way we should. And part of it is we did a little survey up in northwestern Minnesota. The increased cost of fuel and the increased cost of bus purchases. The districts have been very good about maintenance, and they're very cognizant that they have to do that. But the replacement of the equipment and the cost of just general operating has gone up a lot in the last few years. And so we need to, as a legislative body, we need to try to address that increase. And otherwise, we'll end up a few years ago where we had these carpenter buses that were, the company went bankrupt, and some districts had these buses in service yet that were not safe. They had to go 35 or 40 miles an hour was their top speed. And so they just used them, you know, in short runs. But we do have to be aware that our school districts have a need for the money to, you know, maintain and keep up that system.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, if I could address that. In my real world, I work around buses quite a bit, and I don't think there's maybe a school district or a private bus company that wouldn't be willing to look back to a categorical funding for transportation. So,
Senator Pariseau.
As long as we've done a little bit of policy, I have one policy question, and it's probably going to be directed at Senator Stump or whoever else could answer it. Is there any what is the percentage of the bus ownership district-owned compared to private contracted? And I think there's a real question there whether school districts ought to actually operate instead of just contract. So I always had a question on that. Can anybody answer?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Parra, so I don't have the exact information, but I think it's probably about a half and half.
Really?
When you get in greater Minnesota, most of the school districts actually operate and own the buses. Not all of them, but a good majority of them. And I think in the metropolitan area, much more of it is privatized and ran by private companies. And it evolves over time, but I think one of the provisions that I believe Senator Osteen maybe had in one of the education bills was to try to, I believe it was in the education policy bill, try to look at a way to address multiple routes, you know, where districts might be crossing other districts, and figure out if there isn't a better way to be more efficient in our transportation system. So we're going to try to take a look at that, too.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry to distract you.
Okay, further discussion on Senate File 3535. Otherwise, Senator Murphy has moved that Senate File 3535 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Okay, then we have House File 1875, Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's going to be an A1 amendment that I ask to have distributed. The number is House File 1875. I'm actually carrying Senate File 2747, which is the statewide health insurance bill. Apparently there's been a decision that the language of Senate File 2747 will be amended onto a bill that Senator Prentner Solon had been carrying, and I was made the chief author of that bill yesterday as a House file. The bill, the concept of the bill has actually passed the Senate in 2005, did not pass the House last year. It passed both bodies of the legislature for the statewide health insurance program. The bill was vetoed by the governor. We came back again this year with a revised bill has been heard in the Commerce Committee, the Health Committee, and the State and Local Government Operations Committee. However, there's been a development within the past couple of days, and There's been some opposition from the Commerce Department about the fact that the proposal all the way along would create a self-insured pool by which the school districts would provide health insurance to the school districts in the state of Minnesota, and it's mandatory. The language that you have before you is virtually identical to the bill that has been traveling through the Senate with one major change, and that is instead of a self-insured pool, this will provide for a pool, but that will purchase insurance from established insurance companies, such as, say, Blue Cross. So the risk of a self-insured pool is not there. That was the major concern that the Department of Commerce has had. They saw a draft yesterday. They were okay with the draft, and I believe that the A1 amendment is identical to the draft that they saw yesterday. Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment to put the bill. This is a little unusual because I've had the bill in three different committees before getting into here. Before I actually take further action on it, I'll move the amendment, but let me just describe the fiscal issue that brings the bill before the Finance Committee is the fact that both as a self-insured pool and in the shape that you have before, this would require a loan of $4 million as a loan for the startup cost for this pool. The loan would be paid back in 10 years. Now, whether the $4 million was the number that we've been working off for the last few years as the number we needed to get the self-insured pool board going, whether or not the $4 million is the exact number today or not, we don't know, simply because, as I say, just within the last week, the concept changed, again, from a self-insured pool to a pool purchasing insurance. But there still will be the startup costs, and we don't have any better number to come with besides the $4 million loan that we had previously been working with. That, Mr. Chair and members, is the bill that you have before you.
Okay, and members, I want to make note that in the appropriations section of of the proposed A1 amendment, the $4 million is a cancellation from the budget reserve. And before members get any other bright ideas, there have been a couple of bills that have risen to a somewhat higher level where we have allowed money to be taken from the reserve. If this bill, if passed, would be one. Another issue that did not come through the regular appropriation process was the I-35 bill. Now, in House File 1812, we've accounted for that money as well as the debt service for the bonding bill. So that was taken into account, and obviously all the money is fungible. So whether it's from the budget reductions or from the specified amount in 1812 relative to the budget reserve, those were bills that passed out on their own. This is potentially another exception to the rule, but I will not be hearing any more bills this session that suggest, well, let's take another $3 million from the reserve or anything of that sort. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bitzel, you said that the your amendment is changing. Is it the amendment that's changing it from a self-insured to going back to acquiring insurance from several other entities? How is that different from what it used to the bill that you've had in the past then? Is there some difference between this year?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that was the main difference of the bill in the past, was that it created a self-insured group that was going to provide insurance to the school districts. And I suppose, in the transition period, purchasing it. This group will not provide self-insurance at all. This group is to use the purchasing power of a pool, that is, all the school districts in the state, together to negotiate the best rates and to negotiate the best policies that they can, rather than have every single school district do its own negotiation. Mr. Chair, I should add one point. The previous bills did have and this is of interest, I think, to Senator Berglund. They had a proportion of the share that they were paying to the MSHA program. Now, because of this pool, they would pay the full share. So instead of paying a proportion, they pay the full share. That isn't referenced in the bill. It was referenced in the previous bill because they were proportioning it out. Now, because they are purchasing insurance, they're going to pay the full full share of the tax.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, so this is still mandatory on all school districts?
It is, Mr. Chair and members, it is mandatory. The I'm trying to find the language. It says that the
page 2, line 32.
Page 2, line 32, yes. If it provides coverage, the coverage must be provided, purchased only through the health plans offered. It still provides that there must be, they're going to offer at least 6 plans, and also they'll look at the feasibility of offering coverage of, they'll look at the CGIP, the State Employee Group, and the PEEP, which is small insurance plans as well. There's references to that on page 4, line 10, as possibilities as well, too.
Before we take any further questions, why don't we put the amendment in front of us? Senator Betzold moves adoption of the A1 amendment. If there's no further discussion.
One correction, Mr. Chair. Line 1.1, it says amend Senate File 1593, and I believe that should be House File 1875. That hasn't been corrected.
Okay, that'll be incorporated. So on the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Chairman and Senator Betzold, I don't feel very comfortable at all understanding what this $4 million is for anymore. I understood that they needed some capital to provide a reserve while they got this other plan started, but I don't understand. I mean, if all we're doing is creating a group of teachers who will buy insurance for all the school districts in the state, when all the school districts in the state contribute whatever the cost of that insurance is, why do we need to fund a $4 million amount, and why would it take 10 years to pay it back?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, as Senator Betzold indicated, the $4 million was in fact, you're correct, predicated on considerable amount more work necessary than what was there.
And I'm sorry, if you could just offer the answer.
I'm sorry. My name is Lee Johansson with Education Minnesota. There is still a considerable amount of startup expense that will be necessary to incur in the time leading up to the actual offering. You're correct that the premiums eventually will pay the money to pay back the loan. So they will be paid by the rate payers. But in order to have a plan up and running and offered and members enrolled and negotiations to take place, there's a board of directors that has to be put in place. They have meeting costs. So there will be expenses that will be incurred prior to any premium dollars being received. And that's what the need for the loan is.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, I still don't understand why we need $4 million. I mean, you know, I would think, $2,000 would be a lot for this purpose. We don't happen to have $4 million just laying around here to give out, so I think we should probably be a little bit careful about making sure we have the right amount in this bill.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, $4 million is a large amount, and I believe that, in fact, the work necessary to be done could be done for less than $4 million. I do believe, however, it will be considerably more than $2,000. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of work to be done to bring the plans together, to collect the data, to seek bids, to analyze bids. There is considerable requirement for expertise that costs money and will have to be paid before the first premium dollars come in. So we do need that sort of startup funding. And again, it's a loan. It's not a grant. I appreciate the financial condition of the state. We believe that this will result in long-term savings, however.
Mr. Johansson, I guess I'm a little bit concerned that if $4 million is too high of a figure, can you suggest a more accurate figure?
Mr. Chairman, because this concept was floated very recently, it's very difficult for me to have an informed judgment on that. I believe that we could do it for less, but I have no study to reference to tell you exactly what that amount would be.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple things. One, do we have a fiscal note? And two, are we? And three, if you really want to fund it, we can, since this is a health care bill and it looks like one of the number one, well, one of the top five health care crises in the United States is automobile deaths. If we just put the primary seat belt on this bill, that makes us $25 million. We can all walk away happy.
Senator Murphy, I think it's a good idea if we can use the Trunk Highway Fund.
Mr. Chairman, the $25 million can be, there's a 1.2 of that can be used for whatever the state wants. So we can fund that.
Okay, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzold, I guess I'm wondering about the process of this, because the way you were explaining it, you took over chief authorship of, I guess it was House File 1875, the House file. Then, but that was, I believe you said Senator Prettner-Solon's bill, and I don't know what the underlying bill was. And then we are now amending a new language. And has this language been through any committees? I mean, this is every – we can't answer all the questions because we don't even know 5 or 6 days before the end of session. And this is a major, major change in the whole thing.
Well,
Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, the underlying bill, I think you have a copy of it, and it was a bill introduced to the House by Representative Huntley last year, and as I say a decision was made at a higher pay grade level than the one that I work at was made that this should be a House file. If it passes the Senate, it would go over to the House, and this would be the vehicle to do that. This is not, as I say, everything in this bill not only has passed the Senate twice, as recently as last year, but has been heard in the respective policy committees this year, in the Health Committee, in the Commerce Committee, and the State and Local Government Operations Committee. The language that you have is not new language, with the exception being that instead of making it a self-insured plan, it's a pool that would buy insurance from established insurance companies. That's the only change between the language that you have and that which has traveled not only this session but in previous sessions. And the reason why we made the change, frankly, is because the Commerce Department has indicated quite strongly that they would not support a self-insured plan, but my understanding is that they are okay with having this approach that where it would be a pool to purchase insurance. So that's the only change between what is coming through here. So this is not really brand new things that you're expected to absorb at the last minute. The appropriate committees have seen it, with the exception of that last concept.
And I should point out, three people have asked for the opportunity to testify. Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold, I think that's a significant change, because the initial study that was done that claimed that this would be so much of a savings was based on a self-insured pool. And I guess I think it is a major change, and we're making a major policy change here in finance, like I said, a few days before the end of session, which I don't know if it's it's appropriate.
And Mr. Chair, I know we only got the testimony in. I think that the actuarial study was looking at a pool, but a lot of the concepts from that actuarial study are still true, because the very concepts of having a pool are still applicable in the bills that we've had not only this year but in previous years. But, Mr. Chair, I think we should bring up the witnesses and let them – the people want to have issues and let them testify.
Well, Mr. Chair, just one comment. Mr. Chair, there's a lot of this kind of moving things around and tacking things on to various bills. And, I think we understand why we wanted it on a House file. I don't think that's any big secret. We're convoluting a lot of things, and we're changing a lot of things, and I've been uncomfortable with how we've been handling not only this bill but a lot of bills this year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And, if the target wasn't moving all the time, we probably wouldn't have to jump through all these hoops. But it seems like Senator Betzold said earlier that – well, Commerce was okay at one time, and then they had an issue, so now we changed it so that they're okay again. Do you realize how many gyrations and hoops and hurdles that the last transportation bill went through just to get out of conference committee. And then we got rejected on the floor of the House. Senator Fischbach, it's a two-way street.
Mr. Chair, I can't control the House. Certainly nobody can. No
one can. Well, why do you think we're taking House files and loading them up and shooting them back to them then? I mean, we all know what's going on.
We all have the same problem, Senator Foley.
Yeah, Senator Foley. Mr. Chairman, I think the issue for me is why are we selecting this one group? How are we going to save any money in that sense? And if you can save money by having this size group, why not a little bigger? So we use all state employees or all university employees. That seems to me is what should be answered first.
Okay,
we should make it universal.
We've had a request from everybody. We've had a request from several people to testify. We've talked about the Department of Commerce. I don't know if Mr. Sexton is here or.
Sexton's been here since 8:30.
I think Mr. Murphy's going to speak first.
Okay, Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner at the Commerce Department. My division is responsible for licensing and regulating banks, credit unions, and the solvency part of the insurance industry. We received the delete all amendment yesterday, and I understand the proposal before you is identical. It is a major change from what was proposed previously. The current proposal provides for fully insured health plans where the risk is borne by an insurance company, which is a major league difference from a self-insured pool. Commerce is interested in this matter as the solvency issue, which is pretty much resolved with a fully insured plan. As long as the plans offered are fully insured, the Commerce Department would have no objection to the proposal. One item on page 4, line 415, is a paragraph J in the middle is a little bit mysterious to us, and we're not entirely sure what's intended there, but the last sentence does talk about fully insured plans.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Murphy, then you would recommend to the governor that this bill become law.
Mr. Sexton.
Pat Sexton, Department of Commerce. Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, we don't have an opinion on this bill. Commerce is not in charge of the government, the solvency or the governance of it anymore. It doesn't deal with us. It's a fully insured product. We don't care who buys insurance. We care who sells insurance.
So Mr. Chairman, then the department is neutral. They're not for it or against it.
Mr. Sexton.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, that would be more accurate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your straightforward answer.
Further testimony from the department or questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Is there anyone here from the Department of Administration or the Department of Finance?
Well, we've had a request from the Department of Education. I don't know if there's anybody else who's prepared to testify. They certainly can if they're present.
Mr. Chair, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division at Dewar. I'm assuming when you're referencing finance, you might be asking about this language refers to the Department of Finance because that will be our new agency in about 20 days. Is there anything in particular I can answer for you?
Mr. Chairman,
Berglund.
I guess my question is whether the department, whatever it is, supports this bill and how you would administer this loan if it were passed.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, it's a little hard to say, I guess, at this point because the language is permissive. It allows for, I believe in this section, on Section J, it allows for this group to certainly contracts, if I could use that word, perhaps, or to be in discussions with the Department of Finance. I don't know exactly what form that would take, if we would essentially be licensing the Minnesota Advantage program, which is the program that we offer to all state employees under CGIP, and there's also a similar product that we offer under PEEP. Both of those are self-insured and are run by the Department of Employee Relations, soon to be the Department of Finance. So I don't know if they would essentially just be utilizing our contracts so that they could create a similar plan design, but under a fully insured model. I'm not sure if we would be expected to be a TPA in this case, a third-party administrator. And I'm not sure whether or not we would be, in the end, liable for the solvency of this program. But I'm not stating that we are or we are not. I'm not sure. I did receive the language from Education Minnesota late last night, but this was just sort of my cursory look at it at this point. It would take more research, I think, to answer those specific questions.
And Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Thomas.
And how many people are covered in the state programs that you're, the CGIP programs?
Mr. Chair and committee, under CGIP, it's about 120,000 lives, which equates to about 50,000 state employees. Under PEEP, that group is about 3,000 members. That includes local units of government, which includes cities, counties, and other forms of public entities. I believe there's about 20 entities currently in the PEEP program.
And Mr. Chairman, there's a line 4.8 and says that if an agreement is entered into, persons covered through the pool must be rated separately for premium purposes from other persons covered under the section. And it just seems to me that it makes all the sense in the world that if they decide to go that direction, that they would be rated in conjunction with the people in the pool, because if you have 120,000 people plus another 75,000, the premium should go down. And I know that this has been discussed, but I'm having Mr. Watson work on an amendment that would state that they may be rated separately, but for purposes of the premium, that they could be included in the group, which if they find out that the premium is lower. And that would seem to make a lot of sense to me. I don't know if Mr. Watson is ready with an amendment, but that's something I could possibly do on the floor. But the whole idea here is to get everybody's premiums lowered. And if this would get not only state employees but also teachers' premiums lowered, that would really make a lot of sense to me. So I don't think Mr. Watson has the amendment ready, so I won't offer it at this time. But
okay, Senator Roland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Betzel, I'm wondering now that they go into kind of the private market, although it's kind of the nonprofit market yet with the HMOs, are there six of those in the state that cover the whole state, all corners of the state where all of these educators may be located?
Senator Roland, if you have a question for the witnesses, fine. Why don't we conclude the witnesses and then get into discussion of the bill, unless you'd like to ask a particular question to the witnesses.
But maybe the witness knows the answer to this, too. I don't know, because when we're dealing with the state health plan, we're using various agencies like Health Partners and things. And I'm wondering how many businesses in the state do we have that provide this type of service that would be able to cover the whole state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, essentially, this language is permissive to be to enter into discussions under both CGIP and PEEP. As a point of technicality, even though those pools are operated separately, we do utilize the same contracts. And so if you think about the state employees group, we are corner to corner. We have employees throughout the state. So even though PEEP is considerably smaller, it still utilizes the same administrators, the same networks. So I would expect that that would not be a challenge necessarily should they enter into an agreement under the CGIP or PEEP program, because we already do cover the full state as well as all the border communities.
Why do they need the $4 million?
Further questions for the
Mr. Chairman.
We have Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, as I read this amendment, the role of the Department of Finance is to turn over $4 million from the general fund to this program and then to collect each year a tenth of it to be repaid. And I guess I'm just wondering if you support the idea that you would be doing that.
Mr. Chairman, Jared Jordahl, I'm with the Department of Employee Relations. Senator Berglund, I'm sorry, we don't know the we just got this language yesterday, and I'm afraid we're speaking on behalf of CGIP and PEEP, that element of it. I don't know, I'm afraid, the dynamics of how that loan would be repaid, so I'm afraid we can't comment on behalf of finance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what makes me nervous about this is it puts us $4 million closer to unallotment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, on line 4.12 and 4.13, there's a sentence that says that under this paragraph that they can't become a self-insured pool. Could you just explain what that means in terms of, I know what a self-insured pool is, but does that mean then that they would have to join in with either CGIP or PEEP or some other pool?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, again, the previous versions of the bill that actually were provided that this would be a self-insured pool did say that they could utilize the formats, the opportunities that CGIP allowed. I don't think we had PEEP in there before. But so, again, by switching it over, you know, we just want to make sure that we don't lead to self-insurance because that's not the goal of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me that it becomes irrelevant. I mean, if this group, this pool of teachers and other school employees is going to be buying commercial insurance, that's a whole different thing than what the state employees do. We're self-insured. We take bids on a self-insured product. And so they wouldn't be joined together to do anything, really, as far as I can see.
We have request for, I think, one of the witnesses, Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good morning, Senator. Yes, I think you're asking. You're on the right track, Senator Berglund.
Let me just identify yourself.
I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today. I represent the service cooperatives. I do have a handout. But the service cooperatives are a mechanism which was created by the Minnesota legislature and is self-funded. It used to get state grants, but we're self-funded organizations, nonprofit, and one of the big things we do is provide health insurance to school districts. We have 285 school districts we provide insurance for, 185 cities, 60 counties, 170 other governmental units, housing finance agencies and what have you. 700 plus is the entities we provide insurance for currently, and that's in a free market system. In fact, I know some school districts that recently have even gone after PEEP to ask it to get PEEP quotes, which is a self-insured managed by this doer, and their quotes are coming in 20% higher than what we provide insurance for. So I think we're doing our job under this Minnesota statutes and doing a very good job. In a free marketplace, we are the chosen provider for all of these people because we are cost-effective. The dynamic you have here today, however, is quite significant and quite different. The original study upon which this legislation was premised, it was called the Red and Anders study. You paid $1 million, general fund dollars, to create a study to take a look at this, creating this new teacher pool. That original study looked at fully insured versus self-insured, and it recommended basically against fully insured companies because you lose the benefits of self-insured containing costs. And the costs come in the form of EMCHA taxes, because now this group will pay all fully insured companies pay all the EMCHA and all the provider taxes. Self-insured do not. And in addition to that, the higher administrative costs. So basically at the end of the day, it says filing an insured arrangement the study did, I'm quoting from it, the pool would not have the flexibility to unbundle and shop for stop-loss coverage. For example, we believe that the risk pool, especially a mandatory one, has sufficient size and stability to be self-funded, and that the amount of risk transferred from a pool to an insurer does not justify the added cost of a fully insured, basically, arrangement. It costs more money, and what I just handed out to you basically tells you why. You are buying under a fully insured product, retail, not wholesale. And I think that's significant. You have to understand how the insurance industry works. True, the Department of Commerce does remain neutral on that. Their concerns all along were the self-insured component of that bill, the previous bill. It's not in there now. And their concerns were consumer protection, number one, and number two was the amount of reserves. So essentially what I did hand out here today, it discusses the differences between a retail, fully insured product and self-insured product, what CGIP, the state employee program is, for example, and most of the school districts. Very few go to a fully insured plan. I won't take you through the details of the number because I know you're short on time, but trust me, these numbers have been verified by actuaries, and at the end of the day, moving to fully insured companies and eliminating the service co-ops, we will not be able to bid on this insurance any longer. You put us out of business. When you move to a fully insured product and they take bids only from them, it's going to cost you at least $111 million more per year, because you're going to pay additional taxes and certainly going to pay higher administrative fees and what have you, because that new insurance company doesn't give $150 million worth of reserves for free. They're charging you interest on that money. They have to make those reserves available themselves. So right now you have a system whereby the self-insureds already have their reserve levels adequately set. That's the cost driver. And by the Department of Health's 2006 studies, we can, as this document references, we show you how our administrative fees are a lot less. Our administrative fees are, even for service co-ops, less than CGIP, but those fees are a lot less, administrative fees, than they are for a fully insured company. Essentially, I think that's primarily our concern. Plus, it does institutionalize a couple of things like cash in lieu. That's still there in your bill. I mean, school districts can opt out and pay cash to teachers instead of putting them into insurance pool. I think the governance structure that's created creates a little bit of gridlock for us. And I think fundamentally what this bill does not do, when you go to fully insured companies, or I should say the question this way, or ask the questions, why do you go to self-insured? It's because you can control your costs through the risk that you create. You can provide incentives for people to live healthier lifestyles and what have you. Not so under a fully insured risk. You're not addressing the cost drivers at all with a fully insured company. You are under self-insured. That's why there are so many self-insured metro pools and so many teacher organizations who are opposed to this at the local level, because they have these things. So it doesn't address the cost drivers like the Senator Berglund's bill and Representative Huntley's bill as well. So at the end of the day, I just want to say this bill costs more money forever. At least the original bill, when you went to self-funded, once you built up your reserves, even though it was expensive the first several years over the current system, cost more money, at least the reserves then were funded and you wouldn't have to do that anymore. Here you're going to pay the $110 million year after year after year after year at the retail level. Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Questions for Mr. Straczynski. Okay, we have a couple of other people who have asked, Chairman, for a couple of minutes.
Question that Mr. Straczynski brought up. What prevents the service cooperatives from bidding in this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stump, because we created self-insured pools. We're self-insured. We're not fully insured company.
But where does it say that you can't? It just says that this pool can't become a self-insured pool, but it doesn't say anything in here about not contracting with a self-insured pool.
Mr. Chair, Sarah Stump, page 3, lines 319 to 320. The pool must only offer health plans that are fully insured through a health carrier as defined in licensing. So I don't think they would qualify.
I missed that.
Chairman, we don't qualify, and that's the Department of Commerce. It regulates insurance companies. They don't regulate self-insured pools in the same way under federal exemption. So we are not a fully insured company. Therefore, we could not bid.
Chairman Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if the difference is whether this organization is going to pay taxes or not, I'd rather have an organization have this business that's going to pay taxes. Because otherwise what we're doing is we're simply creating a smaller and smaller base of people that do pay the taxes for the MSHA program. and everybody in the state uses the MSHA program. So it's only fair that everybody in the state should pay for it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I don't know that we disagree on that. We do pay some MSHA taxes, but not the full assessment, nor does any employer that's self-insured pay the full MSHA assessment. Under the fully insured program, they will pay the full assessment. You're correct. So there's some benefit to MSHA, no doubt about it.
We have a couple of other people who've asked for a chance to testify. Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Members, my name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We are not in support of this amendment. We appreciate working with Senator Betzel. He has been keeping us in the process and informed as we go forward. We feel this amendment makes the program less flexible and more expensive than present law and gives fewer choices for employers and employees to go forward from. We have some really real concerns about cash in lieu, which in the bill continues until June 3rd, 2010. And for those districts who do not provide health insurance coverage to their employees, and we believe there are six, this bill would not provide insurance for those people going forward. Also, we have a concern about the six plans being offered. This is the less choice piece. Minnesota Statute 179A.07 tells school districts they must bargain in good faith and for a reduction in benefits. So it seems this would be an automatic rounding going forward into negotiations. We also believe that a mandatory pool would limit competition throughout school district projects. And once again, the reason the Redden and Anders underlying report didn't suggest going with a fully insured product is because it was more expensive for school districts going forward. Senator Stumpf last night on the floor shared some of the local budget cuts school districts are getting, and I think he used the $104 million number at the local level. This would be on top of that districts would have to come up to, and at some point, school districts can't do it anymore. So please keep that in mind as you look at this program. We also have concerns about how reserves would be unwound and how would they be go back to the original districts. I mean, there really needs to be some thoughtful consideration of how you transition from where districts presently are to something like this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Questions from Ms. Schwab. Okay, then Mr. Griffin's asked for a chance to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm testifying today on behalf of Preferred One. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senator Betzel, the changes made to this bill, the major change by the Delete All Amendment, is significant. For years, I've objected to this passage of this statewide teacher pool bill, first and foremost on the grounds that the bill exempted the statewide teacher pool from laws and regulations that control health care coverage. This major defect has been cured, but it is not the only objection that we have to the bill. Preferred One provides TPA services to several major school districts in the state. This bill would eliminate the ability of those districts to choose the manner in which they provide coverage to their employees, namely self-insurance. Ironically, this is the same method that you have approved for yourselves and for state employees. This bill was designed to save teachers money. The payment of fees and assessments on fully insured products will increase the cost of every group of teachers that is currently self-insured. The bill does not solve the problems that the proponents have consistently said is the reason for the passage of this bill. Namely, there are districts not providing coverage to their employees, coverage for remaining individuals and families is too expensive, and increasing health care costs are outpacing the ability of employees, of educational employees, to afford coverage. Please make no mistake about what this bill does and does not do. The bill gives a $4 million loan of state funds to increase unnecessary administrative expensive costs for the purchase of health care coverage for our educational system. The bill eliminates choice for a large number of school boards and their teachers who've worked hard to control the costs of their coverage. The bill does not do anything to control the ever-increasing costs of providing health care coverage. Mr. Chairman, while the Delete All Amendment adopted today cures many of the ills in the legislation, I hope that you will recognize the remaining problems as fatal and vote against its passage. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Questions from Mr. Griffin. Okay, thank you. And we've had testimony from several opponents, and Ms. Alswager had asked for an opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill, so I think that's only fair that she be given the opportunity.
Just another brief salary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. I'll try to keep my testimony brief. You know, now there are seven school districts that don't have health insurance. And I was recently in Austin, and I asked the teachers how many of you think your situation is in crisis. Many of them raised their hands, and I just asked some teachers sitting right in front of me. I said, so tell me what is a crisis for you? And those people told me that for family insurance, what they were paying themselves was $1,400 a month. They lost their insurance. Another teacher said that her mortgage payment is less than what she pays every month for health insurance. This is a solution. It's not the only solution out there because, as someone stated earlier, that universal health or something like that needs to happen for all people. But it is a step in the right direction for all school employees. We've heard people say that this is going to cost school districts more, or some might say that it's going to cost school districts more. I'd like to remind you how this works. The school districts and each of the unions negotiate in their contract how much a school district is going to pay for an individual and family premium. And that is their cap. It could be X hundred dollars per single, X hundred dollars per family. That is how much they pay, and a district won't pay any more until they negotiate more payment from the district. The only exception to that is a district where the district and the union have negotiated that the district will pay 100% of the coverage. That is not the case in family. I don't know of a district that has 100% of family. There are some districts that will have 100% of single. So that is not an issue when you hear that it's going to cost the districts more, except in the cases where it's 100% single. The district would make that choice as to whether or not they want to increase their contributions. We have heard time and time again that the insurance companies, the service cooperatives, the education school, the school districts are working hard to fix the problem. The only thing that's been happening is that the employee costs are increasing. No one has come up with another solution. This is the only solution that has been out there. And as you are well aware, just listening today, as we have worked so hard to address everyone's concerns, and when we do, a new concern comes up. And then we fix that one, and a new concern comes up. There will always be concerns because of the interests involved. We urge you to pass this bill, and thank you again for your support. You've been very helpful in the past, and we appreciate your help. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm confused, and I may need a refresher. Ms. Allswiger, how is this different from the last bill that we had, which I think the legislature passed but was vetoed? Okay. And how is this going to help contain costs for employees? Okay.
Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, if you don't mind, I'll try to address the question. The bill that passed last year did not provide it for the pool to enter into a self-insured plan when it could. It didn't restrict it one way or the other. The bill that has moved through the Senate this year, specifically in its original form and as it's passed through the several committees that were mentioned, said that the pool would have to be fully insured for the first 2 years of operation and then could, assuming that it received the proper approval from Commerce and the other regulatory agencies, move to a self-insured plan. What this bill does is say the pool is going to purchase a fully insured product, and it does not empower them to move to a self-insured plan. So so that's kind of the progression we've got. It should be pointed out that, the state auditor did a report on the service cooperative insurance offerings 2 years ago, I believe. Maybe it's three now. time goes on. And they pointed out in four different occasions when large school districts dropped their coverage under the self-insured service cooperative model and moved to a fully insured purchased product directly from providers that, in fact, their premiums went down. The truth is that if you bargain With a large group, you can still get efficiencies through that bargain. It is a misstatement of a very major proportion to say that there's automatically going to be an increase in aggregate costs if we use this model. There's many examples that that's not the case. I would point out that same report showed that service cooperatives charge $9.85 per contract per month to administer, and the state auditor's report determined that the state pays about $3.50 per contract per month as administrative costs. So again, the claim that somehow or another they're that efficient is at least questioned. We believe that if we put the large block of people together, we can create administrative efficiencies through common plan designs. There won't be 250 different plans that will have to be administered. There will be a half a dozen. We believe that we can create administrative efficiency through bulk purchasing. We believe that through a fully insured product, for instance, we can arrange for mail order prescriptions, pharmacies, where we know there's considerable savings, and we can do it with 200,000 lives rather than broken up. So we believe that there are, in fact, great efficiencies that we can squeeze out of the system. In a perfect world, we would like the flexibility to make the decision to move to a self-insured model, but we don't live in a perfect world, and so this is the compromise. And as Ms. Alzelager pointed out, we have attempted to meet everybody's concerns for many years. We've addressed them. We are now at a point where we believe that we need to act. We need to move forward, and we need to address this crisis because it's bringing down our school employees and our schools.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
All right, we have Senator Thomas.
Chairman, I have a need to amendment, and I think we could pass it out. All this does is on page 4.5 says that it changes that, and the amendment will be coming.
We need the amendment distributed, Senator Thomas.
I think this just makes good sense because it says that.
Senator Thomas, can we have the amendment distributed?
Mr. Chairman, the changes would actually be on lines 1.7 through 1.10 of the amendment, and it just says if the pool and the commissioner determine their premiums would be lower if the plans are rated in conjunction with the plan offered by the commissioner, the pool's health plans must be included within the contracts for the plan offered by the commissioner. So in other words, it gives another option so that in the event that we create a bigger pool by adding the teachers to either the CGIP or the PEEP, then and they get better options as far as premiums are concerned, that this can be included as one of the options. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Senator Betzel?
I'm fine with the A2 amendment.
Okay, we have the A2 amendment in front of us.
Chairman?
Is there further discussion? Senator Stumpf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, how does that interact with Clause E on page 3? Or actually, the last sentence in your amendment has that same language.
Mr. Chairman,
the state is a self-insured pool.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, if you wanted to remove that, I wouldn't mind. What I'm trying to do here is just make sure that if we can get a bigger pool and we can get better results, that'd be an option. I think on Clause E, Clause E refers to the Clause J that we're amending right now. I don't know if it's a good idea to not be able to be self-insured or not. So I'm really not dealing with that in this. I'm just dealing with the possibility of making the pool bigger by adding the teachers to the state employees.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking when you read Clause E, it says that you can't offer a fully it has to be fully insured. Well, the state insurance plan that we have is self-insured. It's not fully insured.
Mr. Watson?
Just seems to be a contradiction here.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson?
Stump,
You're correct. That is a contradiction.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, we could amend Clause E with the sections that are referenced on 1.7. Those are two plans that already have a record of we can go on.
Senator Thomas,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, is there a contradiction already in the original bill?
No.
Before my amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, yes, where the original bill makes that an option, that option actually wouldn't work, since on the one hand it must be fully insured, and on the other hand it
maybe
can't be self-insured.
So we'd either have to delete part of my amendment or do what Senator Fredrickson just said.
Or wait to the floor. Go wait to the floor to do it.
So, come on. Senator Betzel, did you?
Just suggest, Mr. Chair, Senator Thomas, so maybe if you want to withdraw the amendment and then offer something on the floor, maybe that would be a better way to do it so we don't have something in conflict in the bill here.
Senator Thomasoni?
Okay, I'm fine with that. I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Watson what does happen to the reserves that would be held by the service cooperatives on behalf of school districts that would no longer be purchasing their insurance through those cooperatives under this bill. Would the service cooperatives get to keep those reserves, or would they have to be returned to the school districts?
I don't, Mr. Mosman or Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson doesn't know.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mosman doesn't know either.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it's my understanding that the current law says that when a self-insured pool goes out of existence and the run-out costs have all been paid, probably a year or two down the road, that any existing reserves that remain have to be returned to the benefit of those who built the reserve. So my understanding would be it would go back to the districts and those employees who paid the premiums.
Senator Mr. Chairman, do you have any idea how much that would be? I mean, even a ballpark?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, no, I don't. The reserves really have been fluctuating considerably, especially within the service co-ops. I know a year ago the Fergus Falls co-op had a grand total of $16,000 in reserve only, so that probably wouldn't even pay the run-out costs. Others have a more substantial reserve, so it would be almost impossible at this point to give you a dollar figure.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm very skeptical about the potential cost savings for the districts with this plan. And I really, I would prefer the bill not pass, of course, but since I'm concerned that it might, I would like to make sure that some districts that don't want to be in it could be out. And so I would like to offer an amendment to delete Section B on page 2, 2.32 to 2.34, which deletes the mandate that everyone who offers health insurance must go into this pool. And it would leave districts with the option to do some comparison and see if their current EXU plans, which are self-insured, might be better financially for them. It just gives the districts choices, and I think that at this point that would be the best thing to do. Or, I mean, we can defeat the proposal, but I've seen it pass a number of years, and I'm concerned about my districts, and I want them to have some choices.
Senator Betzel?
Well, the past bills have been premised on a mandatory pool, so I would oppose the amendment.
Okay, we have Senator Roebling's amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails. Further
division?
Further, Senator
division.
Division? Okay, all those in favor, if you could please raise your hand. And those opposed? Okay. This time my hearing was a little bit better than the last amendment. So, Senator Fredrickson.
I'd like to make a quick word usage amendment. Page 3, line 36. Delete Dutch A. Insert
Dutch. Where does that get in here?
Senator Betzold.
So that's fine, Mr. Chair. I'm embarrassed.
Mr. Chairman, page 4, line 8, delete such.
Oh, gosh.
And on page 4, line 10, delete such and insert the.
Yeah, she's reading the bill.
Sarah Betzold.
I'm humiliated.
This has been quite a committee hearing. Senator Betzold's humiliated over word usage, and Mr. Watson couldn't answer two questions. So Senator Betzold incorporates those suggested changes by Senator Fredrickson. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions. One is, given that we've identified this contradiction, would it be a good idea on line 4.5 to say something like, notwithstanding paragraph E, just because the bill's internally inconsistent. So I guess I would start by proposing that and see Senator Betzold.
Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair, I think this bill's going to need, again, we had to do a major rewrite in the last few hours. I think maybe we'll have some scrubbing. I'm sure we're going to have probably an author's amendment to clean it up, and probably Senator Thomasoni's going to have his issue here. So, you know, I'd like to have an opportunity to work with counsel to make sure that I've taken care of that before we try to do that here.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I just want to ask Senator Betzold to remember that next time I bring a bill forward that needs a little bit of work.
No,
would you,
Madam Chair,
give us me the same courtesy in the future?
I'm happy to have the bill laid over.
Mr. Chair, I'm not. I'm just asking a question, as some of us have been subject to some rather strict requirements from other senators about, you know, bills being in perfect shape. I'm just asking a question. I'm not asking you to lay the bill over.
Okay, further discussion on the bills. Senator Stumpf.
This is a little more substantive on the policy side of it. And I think on page 3, on the bottom of page 3, I think if, you know, the whole issue of the cash in lieu, you know, if we're talking about health insurance coverage, I don't think that this provision ought to be in there. And I'm not going to amend it or offer an amendment, but I think it's totally inconsistent. If you use, I think, the same people who have cash in lieu of payments can be used as an argument for not having coverage. And I think the way that the health insurance coverage issue has been approached is coverage for everyone, not coverage for most. Well, we'll give you cash in lieu. And I know counties are doing it. I mean, school districts are doing it. It just seems to me that that's an issue that ought not to be part of this if you're talking about health insurance coverage for everyone.
Mr. Chair, it is bad policy to allow people to accept cash and take a chance that they may or may not get sick. And this happened to be an issue through the years that we've been working on this bill, that some groups absolutely insisted that they have that opportunity, but this phases them out of the people who are doing it. But I agree, Senator Stumpf. I mean, we should not be paying people, you know, to not be covered by health care. You're absolutely right.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
I don't know that it means that they don't get covered. It just means that they go and take their dollars and purchase their own plans. They might purchase a health savings account. There's a lot of different things that they can do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the argument was, I mean, some people had maybe better health care through their spouse, so they accepted the cash. And that makes sense. But some people were accepting the cash and not buying insurance. And I think that's the problem. And how do you differentiate one from the other when you just hand the money out and you don't know what they're going to do with it? But the argument was that some people, you know, had better coverage and they did not need this. So.
Okay. Further discussion, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, just one other question. I assume the bill's not being laid over. Is there any indication that the governor will sign this version, Senator Betzold?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no, I don't have that. The governor did veto last year's bill. I have some concerns. If Commerce opposed the bill as a self-insured bill, I know what their advice to the governor would be. I know that the governor had some meetings over the summer. This particular issue was discussed, but what he's going to do with and when it reaches his desk, I have no assurance one way or the other.
Okay, we have
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
there may be some winners, but there clearly will be some districts that are losers, and all of our districts are being challenged financially. And I've heard from many of the people from districts in all kinds of circumstances that for whom this would really be a losing proposition. And I would certainly be one in line to encourage the governor to veto it if, in fact, it gets to him. That's not something we should be doing to our school districts.
Okay. We have House File 1875 in front of us. Is there further discussion, Senator Higgins?
Says to change that.
Okay, we have House File 1875 in front of us. Before the vote, I just afterwards, this is the last bill on the agenda, need to just talk to members for a few seconds afterwards about our committee schedule the rest of the week. So if you can just wait for a few seconds. But if there's no further discussion, House File 1875. Senator Betzel moves House File 1875 as amended to be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
I'm just kind of confused because the A1 amendment is drafted to Senate File 1593. Oh, I'm sorry. I was out of the room.
So we have Senator Betzel's motion. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
What happened to the Lynch bill?
That was taken pulled from the agenda. So thank you, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then before we adjourn, just a couple of comments. If we could just have your attention. We don't have any further bills in front of the committee. However, depending on what happens with House File 1812, that conference committee has concluded its work. So that conference committee is no longer established. And depending on what happens, we may or may not have to have a bill through this committee dealing with the budget on some other vehicle. But obviously that remains to be seen. I'm not sure if there might be other small bills we might have to take up. So at this point, we're not going to have any further hearings. No further hearings are scheduled for the rest of the session, depending on those caveats. The other thing I should announce before we adjourn, I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. But before we adjourn, I'd be remiss if I didn't announce that this is probably the last committee meeting for Jane Gelbin, right?
Oh.
Last committee meeting ever. Oh. Because Jane, like so many other people around here, decided she needed a graduate degree to go on with her life. And she's going to what's considered the best, most highly ranked public administration school in the country at Syracuse. You're going to be like an orange man or an orange person or something. Is that right? An orange person. And
Madam Chair. Mr. Chairman. As an alumni graduate,
that's right.
I commend the school, and they have a long, long list of very influential people that graduated, not including me. But
we'll see if Jane can.